This is The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Monthly and The Saturday Paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free superfund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper's the source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and The Monthly is the country's best magazine of politics, culture, and ideas.
Hi, I'm Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute. Welcome to the Lucky Country. Is tax the price we pay to live in a civilised society, or is tax theft? After 30 years of bipartisan support for tax cuts in Australia, the ALP went to the last election promising to close tax loopholes and collect more revenue. They even promised to spend more money on services. Australian political pundits have been struggling to catch up with the new normal ever since. In recent months, the ALP has doubled down on their strategy and promised not just to block the company tax cuts, but to close even more loopholes, including abolishing cash refunds for dividend imputation credits. The result is we're finally having a genuine democratic debate about the size and role of government in Australia. In this edition of The Lucky Country, I'll be talking to Ben Oquist, Executive Director of the Australia Institute, about why he thinks Australia should be collecting more tax, not less. We'll also be talking to Professor Frank Bongiorno from the ANU about why Australia spends so much time and so much money commemorating the wars we've fought in, and why it is that our National War Memorial accepts corporate sponsorship. You might have heard that weapons manufacturers sponsor the Australian War Memorial, but you probably didn't know that the gas industry sponsors the eternal flame that burns in the War Memorial's pool of reflection. And you probably didn't know that in the entrance hall of the memorial, an ad for BHP, the Big Australian, dwarfs the portrait of General Kenneth Ether, the man who commanded Australian troops on the Kokoda Track. Australia is one of the richest countries in the world, and our conservative politicians often make much of their support for our soldiers past and present. But despite our wealth, we require our National War Memorial to show ads. Lest we forget our sponsors. My first guest today is Ben Oquist, Executive Director of the Australia Institute, and my boss. Ben, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
I noticed earlier this week that you retweeted one of my columns making the point that if we collected as much tax as the average developed country, we'd have around an extra $100 billion a year. How did that tweet go?
Well, I'm sorry if this is all getting a bit self-referential for your listeners, Richard, but it was one of my most successful tweets in terms of retweets. I'll just read it to you. Australia is one of the lowest tax countries in the developed world. If we collected the average level of tax levied in developed countries, we would collect an additional $100 billion in revenue this year. And I think it was so popular because it spoke to something that people want to hear but feel. They get told so often that we pay too much tax, that somehow Australia is a high tax country. They've been told that for decades, and to hear the exact opposite and to be told in dollar terms how much extra tax Australia could collect and simply be at the OECD average was startling to people, but also somehow exciting.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, that these facts are kind of hidden in full view. We've had 20 years of being told that we can't afford to do everything, when of course really it's 20 years of cutting taxes.
Well, that's right. And I think we are at an interesting point in the debate. We've had a big debate about whether we should cut company taxes in Australia. And of course now post the 2018 budget, it's shifted to should we have personal income taxes cut? And in particular, should we have big personal income taxes cut for the top end in the future years? And we're settling down into a debate in Australia, one about inequality and whether it's right to be giving tax cuts to both the middle and the top end, as well as the bottom, but also bigger picture, I think, about whether it's better to have increased services and the quality of services increased and more government spending or less taxes. And I think we're right in the middle of that now.
Yeah, so I mean, on the one hand, we've got you know, people like yourself saying tax is the price we pay for a civilized society. But increasingly, and certainly in response to that tweet of yours, there's this growing tax is theft idea. So they're really quite two different ideas about what not just what tax is, but what kind of country we want to build.
I think that's right. I think that the tax is theft idea is struggling. And I think, if anything, we're on a slightly new plane. And while many have argued that Australia is taxes too much and that tax is actually stealing people's money in the past, I think after 27 years of uninterrupted economic growth and after wages have been rising so slowly and with an increase in inequality, I think there's a slight tilt to the other side of the debate at the moment, and I think that's where the debate is settling down.
Well, I guess we'll find out soon, because I heard you say recently the Senate's never blocked an income tax cut, yet this week the Australia Institute's launched a campaign to try and encourage the Senate to do exactly that. Is that crazy brave or perfect timing?
Well, I do think it's interesting. It was in my memory the Senate hasn't blocked income tax cuts before. But what is being proposed this time in the budget is a very radical plan. Not so much the proposed tax cuts for low and middle income earners that start this year, but the longer term tax cuts, the top end tax cuts that kick in 5 or 6 years' time, that eliminate altogether a tax bracket, that raise the top tax threshold from $180,000 to $200,000, that substantially flatten Australia's progressive income tax structure. That part of the tax package is quite radical and comes in a long time away. And I think there is an opportunity this time for the Senate to block those parts of it, notwithstanding the fact that political orthodoxy in Australia is that no party can oppose income tax cuts and survive, and that the Senate never blocks income tax cuts. I do think this time it's different.
It's interesting. I mean, Labor went to the last election promising to collect more tax revenue, not by increasing tax rates, but by closing loopholes. Labor's response to the government's proposed tax cuts was to propose some income tax cuts of their own, mainly for lower and middle income earners, that actually went further. But they're also promising to reduce the budget deficit and spend more on services. How is Labor pulling off this trifecta?
Well, it is interesting. And in one sense, they're broadening the base and lowering the rate. Hmm. They're getting rid of tax concessions and tax loopholes, whether it's negative gearing reform or capital gains tax discount reform or family trusts or dividend imputation, superannuation tax concessions. By clamping down or limiting some of these tax concessions, it's allowing them to offer larger income tax cuts for low and middle income earners, and offer more spending on health and education, and offer a predicted higher surplus than the government's willing to offer. But putting that to one side, I think where the tax debate is going to settle down pretty quickly is what will get through the parliament. And Labor is promising to back the government on its low and middle income tax cuts, but it's not settled yet what's going to happen to those top end tax cuts, whether the government will agree to split the legislation or not, how the Senate will handle it in those last 2 weeks of June.
And so what is the Australia Institute's campaign? How does one try to stop a tax cut?
Well, that's right. It is a big call, as I said, because I don't think income tax cuts have been blocked before. We're really zeroing in on these top-end tax cuts, the ones that remove the 37% bracket in our tax system altogether, and that increase the top tax threshold from 180 to 200. That mean the marginal tax rate for somebody on $41,000 would be the same as somebody on $200,000. And it would force the government to split the bill, and to say that, well, yes, we'll take the opposition at its word and pass the low and middle income tax cuts, but the bill will be split and would allow the Senate to block the top end tax cuts. But that's all to be played out. We don't know whether the government will agree to that. the big picture, we're really making the point that not only is this unfair, these top-end tax cuts, and overall we see that 62% of the benefits go to the top 20% of income earners, that's of the whole tax package, and the bottom 30% only get 7% of the benefits. Not only are these tax cuts unfair and will increase inequality, we really think they're fiscally irresponsible. And they're not what a conservative would offer up. They're very expensive. The government own estimates suggest the total tax package will be $140 billion over 10 years. But the tax cuts themselves don't come in until 5 or 6 years away, at a time where we don't know what the budget position will be, we don't know how much revenue will be coming in, we don't know what economic growth will be doing, we don't know if wages will be growing as the government has predicted. It would really be very imprudent.
I've got to correct you there, Ben. I've read the budget papers. I mean, they've forecast these things out for 10 years. The government knows exactly what's going to happen, don't they?
Well, they predict and they forecast, and inevitably some of those forecasts are wrong. And that's why it's a really not a conservative approach to legislate now for such expensive tax cuts in 5 or 6 years' time. Remember, these top-end tax cuts, unlike the ones directed at low and middle-income earners, don't start next year. They start in 5 and 6 years' time. And that's why it's we think it's pretty fiscally irresponsible and not conservative policymaking to legislate now for something that starts in such a long time frame.
So what's the government up to? Why not just cut taxes for high income earners straight away? Is it that they can't afford it, or they know they can't get away with it?
Well, I think it's that a bit of both. I do think they couldn't possibly put that kind of much revenue loss in the forward estimates now. They have to bank on rosy wage growth forecasts, rosy revenue forecasts, and promise to make the tax cuts then, and not have to account for any offsetting spending decreases. It's much easier to promise those tax cuts in the future, make it look like you're going to give something to people, but not really have to account for what that might result in spending cuts. And I guess that's the point, that to pass tax cuts now will lock those tax cuts in. Could be very hard to raise taxes in the future. And then come 5 or 6 years' time, the next government or this government will say, well, we've got to cut spending because the money's not there, the revenue's not there because we cut taxes before.
Just finally, the government seems to have discovered the fact that high-income earners pay a lot more income tax than low-income earners. This seems to have come as a big surprise to them that under a progressive tax system, the people who earn the most money are paying the most income tax. Where do you think this problem is coming from, and what does it mean in Australia to flatten the tax rates, as you were saying before?
Well, this is a central part of the debate now, because the flattening of our progressive income tax system is what is being proposed. It's not being made completely flat, but it's certainly flattening it, and the Prime Minister has boasted of this. And the problem of that is it means that the wealthier you are, you won't pay proportionally as much more tax as you used to under our old system. And the point, though, of a progressive tax system is just that, is that if you earn a lot more money, you pay proportionally more money. And, of course, if you look at the tax stats and see that, well, the wealthy are paying a disproportionate amount of income tax, kind of proves the point that the wealthy earn a lot more money than the poor people. Here's the reality, is that in Australia, and I don't think people realise this, that the 10 wealthiest families probably own approximately as much wealth as the poorest 4 million Australians combined. And a progressive income tax system is meant to address that somehow. A lot of our other taxes, such as the GST, are regressive, as we know. And a progressive income tax system is one way of helping level that playing field.
Well, Ben Oquist, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country, and I hope your campaign goes well.
Thanks, Richard.
That was Ben Oquist. He's obviously willing to pay a bit more tax to live in a more civilised society, but we'll have to wait till the next election to find out what the rest of Australia thinks. Our next guest is Professor Frank Bongiorno from the Australian National University. Frank's an historian whose research focuses on the way Australians remember their wars. Frank, what's so important about Anzac Day?
Well, Anzac Day, I think, is probably the closest thing we have to a national day. Australia Day has been very controversial for a long time, very contentious. Anzac Day can be contentious too, but I think has in some ways been less so, I think, in recent years. Certainly more people feel that they can identify with it. For Indigenous people, for instance, it seems to be, at least for many of them, a more comfortable day than Australia Day is, for pretty obvious reasons. It was a day that many people thought was dying out, but it's been reinvigorated, I think, in the last 20 or 30 years. It seems to perform a function for a lot of people as a kind of, signify a kind of sacred nationalism, I think, in many ways.
Is it a celebration? Is it a memorial? Is it a public holiday? What do you think Anzac Day is?
Well, I think it's all of those things. Many people would deny that it's a celebration, but surely it does celebrate the making of the nation. I mean, it usually carries that kind of function. It's commemorative in the sense that it does draw attention and it does seek to remember those who've given their lives in wars, not just the First World War, but wars across more than a century. So it clearly performs a range of different functions, and it may well be that any national myth, and indeed any national day, does have to have kind of multiple meanings of that kind if it's going to endure, because we're a very diverse and plural society.
So in recent years, Anzac Day celebrations have become bigger. They've become more political, in that political leaders are keener to be seen at them giving speeches about what Anzac Day means to be Australian. But it's not just Anzac Day. We now spend a lot of money and a lot of time remembering other famous battles, particularly from World War One, it seems, and building more and more memorials, not just in Australia, but around the world. Given we're told we're so broke in Australia these days, why so much money to remember 100-year-old wars?
This one British historian joked that the Australians seemed to want to put a memorial in Europe to everywhere an Anzac took a piss in the First World War.
That would be an interesting map.
It would indeed be an interesting map. The level of investment in commemoration is now enormous. It's estimated that Australian governments and the private sector between them probably spent somewhere between $500 and $600 million for the centenary of Anzac, which is far more than any other country. We're talking about Britain, France, Germany. It may indeed be more than all of the others put together, and I think that says a great deal about where Anzac sits. I mean, there's a long history of commemoration, of course. War memorials were built, right from the beginning, right from during the First World War, a lot of them in the 1920s and 1930s. The big ones that we know about, like the Australian War Memorial and the big ones in the other cities, emerged really in the 1920s, 30s and indeed early 40s. There's been a really intense culture of commemoration in recent years, and governments believe that it's something that people, and correctly believe actually, that it's something that taxpayers are willing to pay for. Money seems to be no object when we talk about war commemoration.
$500 million, that's phenomenal for an economist to hear those sort of sums getting spent on such things. Why do politicians in France and England care so little about dead soldiers?
Yeah, I don't know if they care so little about it, but...
Well, they're not putting their money where their mouth is,
they're not putting their money where their mouth is, yeah. I think that there's been a process in Australia whereby this sense of making the nation is still seen as very much a project in a way that I think is, and making it through war, through using that notion of blood sacrifice, going right back to the First World War, seems to have a real resilience in Australia. I mean, the First World War is a, it remains a much more troubling event if you're from France or from Britain. It's associated more with, the blood, the mud, the tragedy of the Western Front, whereas our dominant images are quite different. They don't focus on the Western Front. They focus on Gallipoli. They're about the storming of the cliffs. They have a much more triumphant aspect. It is leavened by a sense of tragedy. There's no doubt about that. And it's striking, isn't it, that the most, I suppose now, the most famous cultural artefact of Australia's First World War is Peter Weir's Gallipoli, and its climactic moment isn't the storming of the cliffs, it's the tragedy of the Neck in August, where those hundreds of Australians are killed on a piece of land not much bigger than a tennis court. So it's not that that sense of tragedy isn't there, but that there's still, I think, this sense of nation-making and triumph that does sit behind it.
So with that, you talked about the $500 million being not just public money, but private sector contributions increasingly, corporate sponsorship indeed. So sponsors usually want to attach their brand to good things. You know, it's always interesting for me that, you know, you can get private sponsorship for children's hospitals, but not rape crisis centres. You know, the private sector, even though they own tollways, they never put their brand all along the tollway to remind people, you know, who's getting the money. But we now see private sector sponsorship of a building as significant, culturally significant, as the war memorial. Why does the private sector want to attach its brand to such a thing?
I think it's the same principle you just mentioned. There's a lot of reflected glory from Anzac. It has a kind of magic about it. And businesses, including in many cases, of course, you know, businesses like weapons manufacturers who otherwise have a PR problem, find that there's a lot to be gained by attaching themselves to an institution such as the War Memorial, for instance.
I'm confused because the private sector is not allowed to use Anzac in its branding, but weapons manufacturers can brand the War Memorial. Is it a holy thing or isn't it?
It's where, you know, neoliberalism meets, you know, modern memory culture in a lot of ways, isn't it? And yeah, an extraordinary contradiction, I think, for a culture that in many ways was a very democratic one. It was very white and it was very male, but it was also within that very democratic. I mean, Charles Bean, one of the, you know, the forces, if you like, behind the Australian War Memorial, the Australian war correspondent and official war historian, saw Australia of that time, 1915, as a kind of new Athens. So that notion of a democratic culture where, you know, all men who gave their lives, all men who served should be recognised was very powerful. And it's contradicted, obviously, by the ways in which corporate sponsorship is now so prominent in every sense, visually prominent around certainly the Australian War Memorial.
So sticking with the contradictions, often in Australia you'll see people on the political right making the most noise about Anzac Day. Often in Australia you'll hear people on the political right making the noise about freedom of speech, but the freedom of speech isn't really extended to anyone that's got anything critical to say about Anzac Day. Why is that? Why can't an Australian express scepticism about elements of Anzac Day?
Because to do so, I think, becomes a form of blasphemy when it's been sacralised in the way that it has. So it's a bit like, priests or bishops within the Catholic Church don't promote freedom of speech about key theological points of or key church teachings, and that's the case with indeed many religions, and so it is with the civil religion of Anzac, that to transgress, to question aspects of it can come to be seen as blasphemy, and there seems to have been almost a kind of a ritual each Anzac Day in recent years whereby someone goes onto Twitter and says something that offends the law of the tribe, and they're punished. They're punished. They lose their job.
The blasphemer is brought forth.
That's right. They're banished from the country. It's almost got to a place where there seems to be a kind of discussion leading up to Anzac Day about, okay, so who's going to stick their head up this year? I think it is the fact that it signifies a kind of sacred nationalism that means that notions of freedom of speech are at a discount, really, once you start talking about Anzac.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Manning Clark, of course, you know, talked about the enlargers and the punishers and straighteners. And for me, my early memories of Anzac Day kind of probably had more to do with the enlarger spirit, you know, cutting down tall poppies, laughing at, you know, English generals that were incompetent and cost Australians their lives. But then when we see how those that have the audacity to tweet about Anzac Day critically are treated, that looks like the punishers and straighteners might have taken over. And people, as you say, you know, we can laugh at the right, but watching people get bullied into silence is not really something to celebrate, and certainly not really consistent with the Anzac spirit. So I don't know, how do we reconcile this? Are we still the larrikin country, or now do we have to toe the line?
Yeah, I think it does have a strong coercive aspect now. My theory about this is, as it's become more inclusive and, if you like, more civic, it's come to be seen not as the possession of returned soldiers, for instance, so much as the possession of everybody. Everybody can be included. It has a multicultural dimension. Indigenous people are welcomed into it. But the thing about inclusiveness is that if you refuse then to participate, if you say, no, my patriotism's different to that, it doesn't want to draw on Anzac, it wants to draw on something else, well, you can come to be seen as, well, disloyal at best, but, yeah, a kind of blasphemer at worst. So there's a kind of paradox, I think, that inclusiveness can actually produce a kind of coerciveness.
Yeah, I mean, I like Anzac Day. I like the dawn service. I don't always go, but I often go. I like to stand in the dark and remember that people were, and still do, willing to make incredible sacrifices. In modern debate, sacrifices about paying income tax, these people volunteered to give their lives. So how can remembering make us a more cohesive society rather than potentially a more divided one where we run the blasphemers out of town?
Yeah, societies need rituals for being able to remember, for recognising ultimate sacrifice, but we're also, of course, a very secular society. You know, we're a society in which formal observance of religion has been in pretty sharp decline, our census tells us, in recent years. And I do wonder if one of the functions of Anzac, and perhaps particularly for younger people, is it gives them a sense of belonging to something larger and broader and spiritual or numinous. It's something that has a transcendent aspect, I think. And we all feel that. We all can feel it, particularly, I think, once we're participating in those sorts of rituals. I mean, I've done it here. I've been to the one in London, for instance. People talk about how powerful it is to go to one at Gallipoli or at the Western Front. So I think we need those sorts of rituals. They also, I think, are of course, liable to political abuse. I mean, politicians are invariably participants in the most significant of those, particularly, I think, around anniversaries. And inevitably, Anzac is put to work for particular political causes, even when, we're told that it's non-political or it's don't politicise Anzac. But we do know that Anzac is politicised all the time.
So do we need to spend $500 million to do it well? Does the spending of the money help us with the remembering? And if not, why are we spending so much?
Surely not. I mean, and it has really some very powerful critics now too. James Brown, for instance, who, you know, is himself a returned officer from recent conflicts, wrote a book a few years ago, Anzac's Long Shadow, in which he was very critical of the amounts of money being spent, of the disjuncture, I suppose, between, you know, the reverence that surrounds Anzac and, you know, often the lack of interest in the experiences of Australian service people in recent conflicts, the lack of interest in dealing with the problems that they face, the commercialisation of it, the ways in which it's associated with commercial enterprises like promoting booze, for instance, at a time when many returned service people have problems with booze, you know, dealing with the difficulties that they've faced. So, no, surely we don't need to spend those kinds of sums. It is over the top. There are, more localised and surely much less expensive ways of having a vigorous, a commemorative culture that people feel that they can participate in, and which also, I think, recognises those from recent conflicts who deserve to be recognised and deserve to have their both their achievements and their experiences recognised.
Now, just finally, what aren't we remembering? What is Anzac Day leaving out? What is the way that we've come to commemorate not just the Gallipoli campaign, but the Australian soldiers? What are we forgetting?
Well, I think Anzac is cautious and careful around the problems of return, the problems of repatriation, the difficulties and sufferings that those who've served in war have experienced when they've come back. It doesn't avoid the topic entirely, but it's clear that it's only, you know, that the official aspects of Anzac commemoration are very reluctant to go outside some pretty strict boundaries about what you can actually draw attention to. I'd also say that, you know, what we've been defending is sometimes rather soft-pedaled in this. So in the First World War, Australians were defending a white Australia. They feared Japan. Were fighting Germany, but they, you know, certainly our politicians were worried about a potential future threat to a white Australia. But you won't hear the words white Australia and Anzac in the same sentence terribly often. We've also, of course, erased the British Empire, you know, the First World War in particular, and the Second World War to some extent were wars in which Australia was fighting as a part of the British Empire. And there's a sense in which that was erased because it became, by the 1970s and 80s, a bit of an embarrassment. And so we've turned these commemorations into something that's almost about an independent Australian spirit, which it is to some extent, but in fact the big wars of the 20th century were fought by Australians as a part of the British Empire, with all that empires mean in the way that they ultimately rest on coercion and the potential for violence. And I think that you know, against subject people. So I think that you know, there are a lot of things that are essentially placed on the margins, perhaps not entirely excluded, but certainly soft-pedaled in a lot of our Anzac commemoration.
Well, you make it seem like our history is more complicated than just remembering one battle on one day each year.
It is. I mean, you know, there are a lot of different stories. There's a whole argument and debate about, you know, do we just simply place too much emphasis on war as the Australian story in the way that I think the Australian War Memorial does in its promotions. You know, it says this is our story, but in fact Australian history is about multiple stories, and even here in Canberra with our various cultural institutions, we can see, I think, some of the plurality of those stories.
Well, Frank Bongiorno, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
Pleasure. Thanks, Richard.
That was Professor Frank Bongiorno from the Australian National University. If you're interested in the way that neoliberal ideas have influenced Australian culture, take a look at the June edition of the Quarterly Essay. I've written it. It's called Dead Right: How Neoliberalism Ate Itself and What Comes Next. I hope you like it. Thanks for listening to The Lucky Country. We love getting your feedback, so please leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. The Lucky Country is brought to you by Schwartz Media, publisher of The Saturday Paper, The Monthly and The Quarterly Essay, and Future Super, Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund.